Once, not so long ago, and not so far away, there lived a people very kind and unassuming. Isolated for centuries by an inconvenient and unforgiving current, which carried passing ships beyond the horizon to the south, too far to see or to be seen, the rest of the world passed them by. These folk inhabited archipelago number 47, a nest of isles situated in a far-flung region of the Coral Sea. But it is not important where it is, only that it is, that once upon a time it was. The people of archipelago number 47 were not inspired to travel in search of a better world, for they felt so satisfied by their own, and the fierce currents forbade sea travel. They were content to paddle from one sandy isle to another nearby to help with harvest, or deliver some cakes to a neighbor. Violence was not a part of their nature. Brawls and fist fights over opinions or possessions were simply unknown, let alone the concept of military conflict. Occasionally, someone would raise their voice, but then only to call an absent-minded child into supper, or a farmer from the field. A mild climate tempered their human vices to a fault. Theft and covetousness never marred their relations, for everyone had what everyone else had, or could easily obtain it. Sun kissed the islands by day. Warm rains and friendly fogs wrapped them up at night, and each morning, the citizens of archipelago number 47 awoke without anxiety, without sin. And so they had lived without disturbance or calamity for thousands of years.
The signs were all there. The crash was coming. But I could see this only when the crash had come, and when the search for order had been abandoned for something more immediate and more reassuring. And the need for reassurance was constant.
When the modern age at last put foot upon their shore, they politely declined to participate in technological, political, or military alliances. The islands possessed no substantial mineral, cultural, or strategic riches, so the great powers persisted no further. But slowly the people of the little isle began to desire some of the advantages they observed in their visitors' sales brochures. They began to trade for practical items like flashlights and plastic pipe and gas-powered rototillers. True extravagances were resisted simply because they didn't have much to offer as payment, except a unique, a nutritious, and highly flavorful crop that grew rampantly in the red volcanic soil. This plant, called parlot, was profoundly unhappy in any other clime or soil, and therefore provided a special opportunity for trade. Once revealed, it attracted many merchants.
The age of industry arrived in other places, other nations, but not in the 47th archipelago. Life was already full of things to make and things to do. Insofar as they existed in self-maintained isolation, the islands depended upon one wondrous plant, named Parlot, after the spirit who bestowed it upon the gentle people as a reward for their adulation and unself-conscious commitment to peace.
I know that return to my island and to my political life is impossible. The pace of colonial events is quick. The turnover of leaders rapid. I have already been forgotten, and I know that the people who supplanted me are themselves about to be supplanted. My career is by no means unusual. It falls into the pattern. The career of the colonial politician is short and ends brutally. We lack order. Above all, we lack power, and we do not understand that we lack power. We mistake words and the acclamation of words for power. As soon as our bluff is called, we are lost. Politics for us are a do or die, once for all charge. Once we are committed, we fight more than political battles. We often fight quite literally for our lives. Our transitional or makeshift societies do not cushion us. There are no universities or city houses to refresh us and absorb us after the heat of battle. For those who lose, and nearly everyone in the end loses, there is only one course: flight. Flight to the greater disorder, to the final emptiness.
From Parlotte came everything one could desire. Where Parlotte took root, happiness and prosperity bloomed among the people of the 47th, and their children grew strong and never fell ill with fever. The fields were cultivated in joy, songs were sung to dedicate the harvest to all gentle, all knowing, all generous Parlotte, who made the sea to swim in, the sky to bear rain, and the plant that gave all without asking, season after season. And a good thing it was, because very little else would grow in the strange red volcanic soil. Scrubby succulents, some were good for spice, chewy black bushes, and less soaked for 2 years in seawater caused a rash. Spiny bonewood, a steady diet led to blindness. The scarcity of resources was reflected in ancient legend. Turbulent surrounding seas repelled fishermen. Strange fruits brought fever, stupor, and death. Slaughtered animals brought the wrath of the winds and skies.
Parlotte was treasured for its medicinal virtues and culinary diversity. A tea from the leaves had a calming effect, and one from the seeds soothed the throat. Healing plasters and poultices were made from the leaves. The stalks and stems and leaves were rich in nutrients. Steamed or baked in pies made from root flour, they were savory without parallel. The seeds could be slowly roasted, ground, and percolated for a mildly stimulating drink. And of course, it made a delicious dark beer. The root was flavorful both raw and cooked, and was the basis for dozens of dishes, one boiled, mashed, baked, roasted, mashed and baked, roasted and boiled, mashed and boiled, mashed and fried, fried and boiled, or dipped in honey.
It has happened in 20 countries, islands, colonies, territories. I cannot see our predicament as unique.
You talk of escaping to the simple life, but you don't mean what you say.
Just about everything on the islands was made from, held together by, or carried in a piece of the plant. The resilient stalk was worked into rope, formed into furniture. The clear, sticky sap could be boiled down into a powerful mastic.
The people of the 47th built fine stucco houses with earth and the fallow cuttings of parlot, and painted them with a shell of the bright red clay in which the miraculous plant grew, and sheathed their roofs with leaf shingles. With trade, Harlot now increased its cachet as the center of the island's economy. The plant began to appear the world over on platters of haute cuisine and in children's cereal bowls, primarily because the seeds were spectacular roasted with salmon, and little faces appeared on them when puffed for sugar-coated cereal. The teas were distributed by a homeopathic concern from California, and the beer begat a brewery in Brooklyn. The world embraced Harlot.
It has happened in 20 countries, islands, colonies, territories. I cannot see our predicament as unique.
Sir, if this were all to end tomorrow, what would you do?
Remember when the kiwi fruit was news? Well, a new and exciting flavor is the breaking news tonight on the New York restaurant scene. It's called Parlot and comes exclusively from the 47th Archipelago, a small group of islands in the South Pacific where people have been living on it for thousands of years. It must be good for you. The people of the 47th reach an average age of 96. Those health-minded consumers seeking longevity and strength can kiss yogurt and broccoli goodbye, and some hard-earned dollars. A mixed plate of parlot, steamed greens, grilled root, and a colorful ratatouille topped with an amazing sauce goes for $87, not including gratuity, at Tribeca Grill. Sides are available for $30 each, and it's spectacular with salmon. If you consider yourself a gourmet, or at least a serious dabbler in the latest culinary trends, the Union Square Cafe will be hosting a parlot tasting this coming weekend from noon to midnight, where $50 will introduce you to samples of 25 different dishes, everything from pickles to breakfast cereal. Tickets will be sold on a first-come, first-served basis, so get online. If you're willing to wait for your first taste, Parlot should be available next fall at specialty stores throughout the tri-state area at a projected price of $48 per pound.
Do not misunderstand. Do not accuse me of presuming. Understand my unsuitability for the role I had created for myself.
You talk about the pace of political change, but that is not the pace of creation.
Great clouds sailed above the islands in a pure blue sky, their progress maintained by a loving breeze. The crop came up green and tender, just as it had in all memory's time. The new yellow blossoms were plucked and consecrated in a special sauce in honor of first growth. This elixir was given to each eldest child in every family, as it had been for centuries. Mothers and fathers woke the next day to a mewling, a laughter, the sounds of feet on the roof, the clatter of pots in the yard. One boy jumped like a frog and plucked at his hair. Another was counting the ants in the courtyard. A little girl was spinning, spinning, spinning with her arms outstretched, calling out this song. You are to the fourscore and the third power. The tenets of dolphins are impossible to fly. Cry, you hungry souls. I will eat you by and by.
I never had the frenzy, the sense of mission, the necessary hurt.
A thousand generations, but not one more.
A thousand generations, but not one more. The behavior of the white-furred squirrelets, known to nibble on the tender shoots, became downright bizarre. The squirrelets now ran constantly, exhaustively, and recklessly, and they ran backwards. The stinging bug flies that nested in the parlot leaves now flew not across the fields, but up and down, and up and down into them, like dive bombers. The birds didn't fly at all. Birds all over the island were walking, wings outstretched like solar-powered mice. And they sang constantly, day and night. Parlot had made them mad.
It has happened in 20 places, 20 countries, islands, colonies, territories. These words with which we play, thinking they are interchangeable and that the use of a particular one alters the truth. I cannot see our predicament as unique. The newspapers, even today, spell out situations which I can think myself into. They talk of the pace of political change. It is not the pace of creation. Nor is it the pace of destruction, as some think. Both these things require time. The pace of events, as I see it, is no more than the pace chaos approximates in the end, after the heady speeches and token deportations, to a continuing order. The chaos lies all within.
I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the foundation of the world.
Reports that a new disease has reared its head in the South Pacific have been confirmed today by World Health officials. The disease has affected, so far, only the citizens of the 47th archipelago. The symptoms of the affliction include stupor, temporary blindness, mild seizures, and inappropriate social behavior. At least one-tenth of the population has been gripped by the disease. The World Health Organization is trying to determine the source of the disease, which is currently believed to be waterborne or related to a possible contamination of the local food supply.
I will utter things hidden since the foundation of the world.
Lunatic. Stark raving. Off one's rocker. One sandwich short of a picnic. Possessed. It did not discriminate. It did not mediate. It did not relent. Anyone who had tasted the parlot that night was now chattering lists of colors, or dancing to the sound of the sea, or conversing with the hat rack. They didn't recognize their own children or their spouses, and when they looked in the mirror,
They just saw a glob of color. But they didn't care. They were entranced by an overwhelming feeling of serenity. Everything seemed new and different and fascinating. Perspective, proportion, shape, color, and sound beckoned them with strange propositions. Run slow. Climb sideways. Sing noise. Scream love. Cry jokes. Spin still. Pee upwards. Dive at the sun. The neighbors watched in panic as their friends joined the mad animals for a roll in the mud. When approached, the affected ones recited gibberish, argued the obvious, and told lie on top of lie. It was madness plain and simple, and it didn't go away the day after or the day after that. It was as clear as a frog on a cherry pie. Anyone who ate the crop was going to go mad.
The elders called a meeting in the town square to listen to reports of what the people had seen. Parlotte was responsible for the hysteria. Those who had touched the crop were falling ill as well as those who had eaten it. Farmers sat through the meeting in a stupor, staring at a single spot, and women who had prepared the sauce laughed unpredictably and batted at invisible pests. The crop was poison. Its effect was clear to those who had not eaten of it. The friends and neighbors of those afflicted shook their heads and sobbed in fear and despair.
We talk of escaping to the simple life, but we do not mean what we say.
As the months passed, the situation worsened. Who could say whether next year's crop wouldn't also come up tainted, or if anyone would live long enough to find out? All attempts to purify the stuff they had through cooking, burning, straining, aging, bleaching, and the like failed. Soon, every living creature on the island except the humans was intoxicated by the bizarre effects of the crop. The atmosphere saturated with chaos and unpredictability. People became desperate as their stores ran low, so with a little prayer, some ate the poison match and invariably veered into madness.
The women had dressed with unusual care. Most of them had clearly spent the morning or the afternoon at the hairdresser's. There can be no surprise, considering my own mood, that the occasion should have gone wrong or should have been turned into an occasion of another sort. I was never sure exactly how it started. Possibly the example of recent breaking up parties was unfortunate. At an appointed hour at these parties, usually after drinks and just before food, guests were required to destroy certain things indicated by the host. Glassware and china from sets that had been irredeemably decimated. Items of furniture that had been overtaken by a racing taste. An old style radio, toys that had been outgrown, might have also been that boredom against which we all fought. And indeed, after the champagne, and the caviar on buttered toast, and the barbecue, what was there to do? What was this new thing that could hold us? After the thrill of the campfire preparation of food, what could we do except eat the food? And then there was the swimming pool.
A swimming pool is a most tedious thing. You get in and you swim 12 lengths and that's fine. But if you're not a swimmer seeking exercise, if you're nothing more than an extravagant bather, if you wish to be in a swimming pool only to savor the luxury of being in a swimming pool at night with uniformed attendants who, at a wave, hurry to the pool's edge with trays of food and drink and appetite-killing variety, if you wish to do only that, you're soon restless. And it was there, in the tedium of the swimming pool, that everything began, I'm sure. There were calls from the pool for balls, for games. Was it from the American's hefty hand that the ball was sent flying among the tables, breaking plates and glasses and cracking a window? I'm not sure. But within seconds, the ball was sent from hand to hand, from pool to house to pool again, and there was a positive, destroying fury. The pool was set centrally, so the damage was satisfying and easy. There rose excited laughter. It seemed that at first, releasing sound of breaking glass and china, a sort of hysteria had set in among our guests. Everyone pretended to be drunker than he was. Everyone was suddenly very active. But for the first time since I had come back to the island, I knew an anger. A deep, blind, damaging anger. I shouted, I screamed. I did not know where I walked, or who I hit, or what I said after the presentiment of anger broke up through me. Just pictures of the disturbed blue of the pool, rocking to rest in an instant of stillness, of the splashed edges of the pool, the bright lights, the recessed areas of gloom, the flies fluttering above the caged underwater light, the faces of one or two registering so clearly the thought that I had gone mad. About me, the splashings and the spilled drinks and the wasted food.
It was agreed that two courses of action remained: to perish from starvation, or to eat the tainted crop in unison and join those who had entered a new and inexplicable world of perception. Since the affliction was not destructive, it was decided that all would eat the crop. But first, a grand reminder of the uncharted world would be built, a monument to send a message of a broken link with reality. There was hope that the statue might act as a beacon, summoning the people back to reason.
Courage, I've said. It takes courage to destroy, for confidence in one's ability to survive is required. About survival in those early days, I never thought. I never saw it as an issue. When I did see it, it was too late, because by that time, I had ceased to care.
And sir, if this were all to end tomorrow, what would you do?
He asked, and sir, if all this were to come to an end tomorrow, what would you do? It was my technique to instantly begin a reply to any question, but so many absurd pictures came to me. Relief. This was my first reaction, and it was a reaction to the man in front of me, not in any unkind ways, for with the word came a picture of myself in some forest clearing, dressed as a knight, dressed as a penitent, in hermit's rags, approaching a shrine on my knees, weeping, performing a private penance for the man in front of me, for myself, for all men, for whom in the end nothing could be done. Relief, solitude, penance, peace. Words and pictures came confusedly together. For a tremulous instant, I felt a suffusing joy to suffer for all men. Do not misunderstand. Do not accuse me of presuming. Understand only that center of stillness, that withdrawal, that compassion, which was really fear. Understand my unsuitability for the role I had created for myself as a politician, as a dandy, as a celebrant. But it was in this role that, recovering quickly, I replied, "Why," I said, "I would return to my business affairs and the life I had led before, in the days of my marriage. It had been a pleasant enough life." And I spoke sincerely, as though in the drama we had created, it was possible to simply step down and return to the order of the past. As though I hadn't seen the point of the reporter's question. What made the reporter ask, I wonder? Some personal insecurity, perhaps? A weak man's wish to tease? Whatever his was, he had his revenge. "Be kind to those you meet on the way up," runs the saying, "for they are the very people you're going to meet on the way down. Frivolous, and very safe, and very smug." The tragedy of power like mine is that there is no way down.
"I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the foundation of the world."
The finest artisans constructed the statue quickly and solemnly, working day and night, often with an audience of several hundred inhabitants who stared at the emerging form, concentrating, memorizing, hoping to affix its meaning to the minds they would soon abandon.
And so each man was now alone.
The statue is beautiful. A man, a woman, a child, with animals and birds curled at their feet, face the west. In one hand, each holds a parlot plant. In the other hand, each holds a mirror in front of a face whose eyes are shut tight. The base of the statue reads, "Peace to you and your family. You have eaten of the poison crop and must truly be mad today and in all days which follow."
"I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the foundation of the world."
It was as though in a tug of war contest, the other side had suddenly let go. It has happened in 20 countries like ours. The sobering moment of success when play acting turns out to be serious. Our grievances were our reality, what we knew, what had permitted us to grow, what had made us. We wondered at the ease of our success. We wondered why no one had called our bluff. We felt our success to be fraudulent, but none of this would have mattered as much if we hadn't also understood that in the game we had embarked on, there could be no withdrawal. And each man was now alone.
Thank you.
Politicians are truly people who make something out of nothing. They have few concrete gifts to offer. They're not engineers or artists or makers. They're manipulators. They offer themselves as manipulators. Having no gifts to offer, they seldom know what they seek. They might say they seek power, but their definition of power is both vague and unreliable.
Now surely design implies a designer of, as effect requires a cause, and so is empirical witness born today with emergence from the primeval void.
I power the chauffeured limousines with the fine white linen on the seats, the men from the special branch outside the gates, the skilled and deferential servants, but this is only indulgence and can be purchased by anyone at any time in a first-class hotel. Is it the power to bully or humiliate or take revenge? But this is only the briefest sort of power, and it goes as quickly as it comes. And the man who is the true politician is willing to play the game all his life.
From a non-uniformitarian zone of unstructured randomness, of dissembled parts in the form of electrons, protons, hydrogen nuclei, which then fuse together, their likeness being that of a device to be assembled whose parts materialize in a box or a crate and then assemble themselves.
A politician is more than a man with a cause, even when this cause is no more than self-advancement. He is driven by some little hurt, some little incompleteness. He is seeking to exercise some skill which even to him is never as concrete as the skill of the engineer. As to the true nature of the skill, he is unaware until he begins to exercise it.
Into a system of structured law, design, purpose, and unbalanced complexity, prepared in its own terms as a device for the far greater and likely unique atomic and molecular complexity of this slight razor edge of possibility, which is our Earth.
How often we find those who, after years of struggle and manipulation, come close to the position they crave, sometimes indeed achieving it, and then are failures. They do not deserve pity. For among the aspirants to power, they are complete men. In any way, it will be found that they have sought after and achieved fulfillment elsewhere.
Followed by the implantation here is it cannot arise of itself of life. And for those who do not hide the knowledge of the actual characteristics of so many real species,
it takes a world war to rescue Churchill from political failure.
Being impossible to emerge in stages or without the guidance of external genius. Mutations plus natural selections plus eons of time or not.
The true politician finds his skills and his completeness only in success. His gifts suddenly come to him. He who was once mean and intemperate and infirm now expresses unrevealed qualities of kindness, generosity, and swift brutality. Power alone proves the politician. It is ingenuous to express surprise at unexpected failure or unexpected flowering.
It's manifest programming from on high, and the ultimate emergence of the material sculptured foreshortened.
More often we see the true politician in decay, his gifts unexpressed, his skills undiscovered turn sour within him, and he was once kind and generous and fighting for the good cause turns out to be weak and vacillating. He abandons his principles. With every defeat, he becomes more desperate. He loses his sense of chiming, changing too early or too late. He even loses his sense of dignity.
Truly the likeness of all this world is a bird that is born, a peacock that develops, and as per the main thrust of Genesis analyzed elsewhere, thus there is a spiritual or psychical connection with all matter, energy, quanta. That is all being. And as our scripture affirms, it is before everything, and in it everything holds together.
He becomes a buffoon, contemptible, even to himself, except in the still hours of the late evening when he has no audience save himself and his wife, who, though embittered, remains loyal because she alone knows the true man, and through it all, he never gives up.
Indeed, it is this. Is the ultimate subatomic zone of contact with zone of emanation from the mind of the dreaming is to be inferred by the following points of demonstrable open contact with the psychical or spiritual. It's manifest non-reprogrammable idealism. Number one, that underlying DNA at all times.
There is your true leader.
Number two, the reprogramming of life for new species. Number three, that is seen
here's
by
your
the
true
initial
historical
emergence of life. Number four, that reprogramming of life for new species. Number five, that initial historical emergence of matter, energy, quanta.
Organization and the FDA have issued a warning against one of America's favorite foods. The Parlotte plant and its products are in the process of being recalled from the shelves of retail markets everywhere in the United States. The mass hallucinations and seizures suffered by the natives of the 47th archipelago have been traced to Parlotte. Consumers who have eaten the plant fresh within the last 48 hours are strongly encouraged to see their doctors immediately. Anyone who has canned or frozen products, or especially the popular breakfast cereal, Face, is strongly advised to dispose of them immediately. Children are more rapidly affected by the contaminated Parlotte. Although it is unknown at this time if any of the export products have been affected, no chances should be taken. The hysteria induced by ingestion of this plant has no known antidote, and the effects so far seem to be irreversible. For more information concerning this potential health threat, or to report any strange behaviors, call 1-800-PAR-LOT. Be careful out there.
I never had the frenzy, the sense of mission, the necessary hurt.
I will open my mouth in parables. I will utter things hidden since the foundation of the world.
For here is a new order of a sort. But it's not mine. It goes beyond my dream. In a city already simplified to individual cells, this order is a further simplification. It is rooted in nothing. It links to nothing. We talk of escaping to the simple life, but we do not mean what we say. It is from simplification such as this that we wish to escape, to return to a more elemental complexity.